Para mi familia, siempre estoy en mi mejor momento. Por eso también quiero lo mejor en mi cocina. Y eso significa solamente huevos de Eggland Best. Siempre tienen un sabor tan fresco y delicioso, con 6 veces más vitamina D, 10 veces más vitamina E y 25% menos grasas saturadas que los huevos comunes. Entonces, ¿por qué darle menos a tu familia cuando pueden tener lo mejor? Eggland Best. Mejor sabor, mejor nutrición, mejores huevos.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light, riding the waves that are just out of sight.
Welcome, I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Zurich. I got my scientific chops studying active volcanoes, using geophysics and geochemistry, and this is Whimsical Wavelengths, where we over-explain disaster movies. And this one's completely in my wheelhouse. So today is the primer for Dante's Peak. The best volcano blockbuster ever made. Is that a hot take? Well, let's leave that debate behind. It is definitely the highest grossing one, raking in $178.1 million at the box office, with a production cost of $116 million, meaning in 2024 dollars, it made over $100 million. Or in other words, it was successful. I guess it's hard not to be. With Pierce Brosnan and Linda Hamilton as the power couple, James Bond as a volcanologist. Honestly, it's flattering. I also don't remember the acting. I honestly don't remember if it was good or not. I'm being serious. Leave it to the nerd to only remember the volcano bits. Besides those numbers and the general location, that Cascade volcanic arc, I'm leaving the movie and its plot alone for this episode. I also haven't seen the movie in well over a decade, and have read almost nothing about its plot and other things about it to keep my biases at bay. So it's not exactly fresh in my mind, although, as I said, I still remember the volcanic activity in the movie. So in this episode, we will discuss what I think is required scientifically to understand the good bits and the absolutely crazy bits from Dante's Peak. That's right, in this episode is where I try to show that igneous is bliss, and that puns so bad, like that one, it really takes a bolder person to fully enjoy them. So I'm absolutely looking forward to the next episode where we watch the movie with some of my fellow colleagues. At this point, as I write this and record it, I don't know the format of that just yet. I'll wing it, chop it up, interject with some explanations and the like. For the moment, let's dive into what is the Cascade Volcanic Arc and why there are volcanoes there in the first place. The Cascade Volcanic Arc extends from Northern California northward through Oregon and Washington and into beautiful British Columbia, Canada. That's right, I'm from British Columbia. You can probably tell. The Cascade Volcanic Arc, it forms part of the Pacific Ring of Fire due to the plates converging and plates pulling apart along the edge of the Pacific Ocean. There is volcanic activity and seismic activity surrounding the whole Pacific Ocean, and that's why it's referred to as the Ring of Fire. So the Cascade Volcanic Arc, it's there because of plate convergence. You know, it's just so hard to know just how far to pull back. I'm referring to plate tectonics. The Earth is made up of layers, and the top layer is relatively thin and brittle, and we call it the crust. Below the crust is the largest layer called the mantle, then the liquid outer core, solid inner core. There's one thing that we talk about as far as plate tectonics goes is what we call the lithosphere. This is the section of the Earth which behaves like a rock. So it includes the crust and the upper portion of the mantle. Basically, if you want it to get it to move or shift, you're going to have to break rock. That's what kind of what it means. Now, it shouldn't come as a surprise to know that the Earth isn't exactly solid all the way through. I'll also say there's very little liquid, but we'll get to that in just a second. I'm going to borrow an analogy from someone else. That someone happens to be the professor that'll be on the next podcast watching the movie with us, and say that the Earth is like an avocado. A thin, brittle, hard crust, a mushy middle, and a hard center. Contrary to some misconceptions I've heard, very little of the Earth's interior is molten rock, like the lava we sometimes see erupting at volcanoes like Hawaii's Kilauea or the recent eruptions in Iceland. It is a solid material which can flow or deform, if you will, over long timescales. And we've all had some experience with things deforming over time due to force and weight, like silly putty. Place a weight on a ball of silly putty, and you'll be able to time how long it keeps moving or flowing. Another example is old, thick glass windows, as they'll be thicker at the bottom of the window than at the top. And I'm sure you can come up with a number of different other examples. The scientific term for this is viscosity. Viscosity is the resistance to flow. Solid rock has a very, very high viscosity, as it won't easily flow or deform under force. Water has a very low viscosity, as it flows easily. The Earth's mantle has a high viscosity, but can and does, however, move slowly. Hit it with a hammer, it will still bounce, much like hitting an old glass window with a hammer. The glass won't flow out of the way like water. To get volcanoes, we need to create melt or magma, i.e. we need to create the liquid. Well, there are several ways to do that. Let us focus on the one which is important for the Cascade Volcanic Arc. So the Cascade Volcanic Arc, the plate tectonics as it's set up, there is the Wanda Fuca plate. It sits underneath, it's a small plate, of the Pacific Ocean, and it is being pushed beneath the North American plate. The scientific term we use is subduction. The Wanda Fuca plate is pushed past the crust and into the hot mantle. Let's imagine what this means by picturing a plate like a dinner plate at, let's say, 60 degrees, angle into hot washing water. There's hot water above and below the dinner plate, where it is inside the sink. That water is also putting pressure on this plate. Think about diving in a pool several meters, say 12 feet. And now think of the crust of the Wanda Fuca plate. As it is subducted, it will have hot mantle above and below it, and it'll be squeezed together due to the weight of the rock above it, much like my pool example. And you can tell by what happens to your ears when you go deep enough. However, significantly stronger, because we are talking about a massive amount of weight of the rock above. This squeezing and heating causes changes in the Wanda Fuca plate and causes the release of volatiles. Or if you want to be a little bit specific, water. One part of this is easy to think about, as it is strictly mechanical. The Wanda Fuca plate is an oceanic plate. Sediment slowly builds on its surface. When it is subducted, meaning it goes beneath the North American plate, some of that sediment goes down with the rest of the crust, and that sediment will carry water and volatiles with it. The other part of this picture is chemical. We see what happens when we leave untreated iron in the rain. It rusts. Iron is not the only thing that changes chemistry when exposed to water. The ocean crust will change as some of the minerals will bring water into their crystal structure. I can spend more time getting into the weeds here. There's a lot more nuance. However, I think that it is enough to understand where the water and the volatiles come from. This water and volatile source becomes unstable, both the sediment and the water locked up in the crystal structures, under heat and pressure while the plate is being subducted, and therefore it is released into the hot rock of the mantle above. Well, if you have been following along, maybe you have the question, why does this matter? Well, it lowers the melting point of the mantle and can generate magma through partial melting of the mantle above it, leading to volcanic activity. Okay, time for an analogy. Where we, up here in Canada, you know, we have to use a lot of salt on the ice, eh? It lowers the melting point of a solid. Yeah, anywhere that has winter knows this. You can put salt on ice, and it lowers the melting point of water. This is exactly what's happening here. We have all these volatiles, instead of salt, primarily water, being released into the hot rock above, and it lowers the melting point of the rock, causing some magma to form. And this magma then begins its rise to the surface, potentially giving rise to volcanic eruptions. Okay, there's the basics as to why the Cascade Volcanic Arc exists and where magma comes from. A brief description of the geologic birds and the bees. Hopefully I did a pretty good job. If not, there's ways to tell me. You can email the show. You can always join the Patreon and get on the Discord server and tell me in person. Or whatever. But now, we need to pivot to the actual volcanic activity. And I broadly will separate them out into six general categories. Volcanic eruptions, i.e. the eruption of magma. And there's some nuance here with phreatomagnetic eruptions and the like, but I'm just going to keep it simple. Volcanic eruptions is the activity for number one, the eruption of magma. And once the magma gets to the Earth's surface, we call it lava. Category two, seismic activity, earthquakes. Generally means some rocks break due to pressure and deformation due to the magma within the volcanic system. Deformation. Pressure changes due to the movement of magma and heat causes the earth to change shape. 4. Hydrothermal. Heat and water from magma at depth cause water to circulate close to the surface. Think hot springs, where you have water deep in the earth, it heats up and rises upwards, sometimes making it all the way to the surface, creating hot springs. There's also passive degassing, or passive gas emissions. Remember all that discussion of volatiles? Well, close to the surface, those volatiles, which were once in the magma, starts to come out of solution. They get removed from the magma because the pressure is less. You can think of a pop or a soda bottle. Before the cap is unscrewed, the carbonation, or carbon dioxide, is in solution with water. Reduce that pressure and it degasses. Magma acts exactly the same way. And lastly, landslides and lahars, or mass wasting. Volcanoes are built by overlapping eruptions of bits of rocks. They are inherently not stable. Then add earthquakes and deformations. Yeah, lots of rock can come tumbling down. Lahars are essentially a volcanic mudflow caused by ash and water. These occur due to heavy rains after an eruption or melting of a glacier during an eruption. Before moving on, we need to have a brief discussion of eruption style. The style of eruption depends primarily on two properties, viscosity and the amount of gas or volatiles in the magma. First, viscosity. Which I've already mentioned with respect to the mantle, which is great. You guys already know it. Viscosity is a measurement of the resistance to flow. Water is low viscosity, and something like silly putty has a higher viscosity. Now hold that thought. Volatiles or gas. We've also talked about those, like in the soda or the pop. As you reduce the pressure on the magma, the gas will try to expand. The larger the concentration of volatiles, the more gas that is trying to expand. So if the magma has a low resistance to flow or low viscosity, the gas can force its way out of the fluid. Think of a shaken soda, or worse, a shaken beer, and then open it. The gas or foam bubbles just come out the top like a Hawaiian eruption. Now imagine a high resistance to flow or a high viscosity magma where the gas cannot escape. The pressure builds until the gas provides enough pressure to break apart the magma, or if it's at the surface, the lava. And when it does this, it breaks it. It's an explosive eruption. So it is a balancing act between viscosity and gas levels that determines if an eruption will be explosive or not. Also, it is nearly impossible to go from an explosive, sticky, high-viscosity magma to low-viscosity magma, back to high-viscosity magma, in the same eruption over a very short duration. Mainly because big swings in viscosity requires changes in the chemistry. There is some nuance here, as there are some strange things that can happen over long-lived eruptions. Particularly in long-lived low-viscosity eruptions at places like Hawaii, due to fractional crystallization and the like. We're not going to get into that. We're talking here with Dante's Peak about a newly awakening volcano in the Cascade Volcanic Arc. And these volcanoes in the Cascade Volcanic Arc generally erupt viscous lava, particularly in the northern part of the arc, or if you're in the Oregon part of the arc, a more fluid one, a basalt. It's very unlikely to switch between the two throughout a single eruptive phase. To be more specific, it is more likely to be explosive in the Cascade Volcanic Arc, but there are many examples, particularly in the Bend area of Oregon, of basalt or lower viscosity lava. Now, given that this is a disaster movie of a dormant volcano waking up, it would be logical to describe what is thought as the standard set of events that signify a volcano becoming active and leading up to an eruption. Okay, the first signs of activity, they are usually an increase in earthquakes. Notice I said increase. Every volcano and tectonically active area has a background rate. It is only when there is more events than the long-term background is it appropriate to speculate what has changed. This also gets to why I can't pick my favorite volcano. They all have their faults. So, I guess it's possible that gas, namely carbon dioxide emissions, or deformation could be seen first, although it's really unlikely. Especially at a volcano, which has been dormant for many thousands of years. Carbon dioxide, the reason why you might be able to see that first is because it's the first gas to separate itself from the melt. So an increase may signify an influx of magma relatively deep beneath the volcano. However, volcanoes don't usually have open pathways from deep in the crust to the surface to degas, at least not on dormant volcanoes. So, well, even if it did exist, it's usually too diffuse to observe. It is reasonable for volcanologists to see deformation first. However, it is still more likely to notice an increase in seismic events, and the technology used for Dante's Peak to achieve this wasn't out there in the wild and used widely. So of the three possibilities I just discussed, they all happen at depth beneath the volcano. So we gotta start there. That's where we're going to expect the changes, is deep within the volcano, not the hydrothermal system or volcanic activity at the surface, because those are due to shallow magma. That's really a key here. You're not going to see a lot of degassing. You're not going to see big flare-ups in hydrothermal systems and the like, unless the magma is really, really shallow. So during a volcanic crisis that occurs at a long dormant volcano, it typically begins with seismic events. They become more and more common and get closer to the surface. The ground above the rising magma begins to deform enough that we can observe it. This phase of increasing seismicity and activity is referred to as the ramp up. As the magma gets closer to the surface, it becomes possible to observe degassing of different chemicals than just carbon dioxide, which we've already mentioned. And while there's several others, I'm just going to stick to one more. Sulfur dioxide. While carbon dioxide begins to degas relatively deep within the Earth, sulfur dioxide degasses in the shallow subsurface. If it is observed, it means magma exists very shallowly beneath the ground. At a long dormant volcano, it is not going to be the first sign of activity, but a later one. At active volcanoes, or recently active ones, changes in sulfur dioxide can signify the first detectable change in activity. But that is not what Dante's Peak has. It's a dormant volcano. To summarize in one paragraph, a volcanic crisis that ends with an eruption usually starts with an increase in earthquakes. Over weeks to months, they become more common and become shallower. The increasing activity or ramp up continues as magma rises towards the surface, causing ground deformation. And when close enough to the surface, degassing of the magma is observable. The activity climaxes with an eruption, after which the activity slows down with less and less earthquakes until it reaches background again. To give a clear example within the Cascade Volcanic Arc, the 1980 volcanic crisis of Mount St. Helens. It had a ramp up time of approximately 2 months. The large Plinian eruption on May 18, 1980, and then unrest with near continual activity until 1991. It's important to note not all volcanic crises end up in a climatic eruption. There's many examples where, I guess you could say, the eruption failed or it just didn't have enough gas to get all the way to the surface. And I think they sort of cover that a little bit within Dante's Peak. And hopefully it comes up during the movie. So I think that covers all the basics. However, this movie plays fast and loose with reality sometimes. It shows activity that is nearly impossible without a ton of time or magma very, very close to the surface. I'm sure we're going to touch on these in the next episode. Haha, foreshadowing. But I think the small primer like this is necessary, especially for how we're going to talk about it, I'm sure. I mean, I'm a little concerned we're going to be talking at it at such a high level, no one will understand us. But you know what? I'm going to cut it up, chop it up, and put it into an episode and hope for the best. One last thing, acid lakes, because this is one of those things I remember from the movie, do occur at active volcanoes. There isn't many of them. And to create one requires persistent degassing of gases like sulfur dioxide into a body of water. The key is persistence. The larger the body of the water, the longer it takes. It is the reason that there isn't many acid lakes. A lot disappear due to drought or too much heat from an active magma chamber. Also, the boiling of hydrothermal systems of a dormant volcano requires magma close to the surface. Unless you're a volcano where there is just a crazy amount of heat already, something like Yellowstone. But if we're talking on the level of, say, a Mount St. Helens back in the early part of 1980, you can't boil the hydrothermal system easily. I mean, at that point, it would already be obvious that a volcanic crisis is underway and an eruption is basically happening at that moment. That said, it might be possible to see an increase in temperature of any hot springs near an awakening volcano due to the activity. But you have to take it with a grain of salt. In other words, the temperature you measure, if you were monitoring it, is a little more complicated, because the temperature of the hydrothermal system also is influenced by the amount of rain and snowfall. Oftentimes, the hydrothermal system at volcanoes will be hotter in droughts, because the only material in the hydrothermal system is from deeper or closer to the magma chamber, so it's hotter. Likewise, with a whole bunch of rain entering the system, it ends up cooling it as all this water enters it from the surface. I think that should do it for now. Next episode, the movie is going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing, especially if it is what I think it is, as I remember. It's been a long time, and I'm hoping that you're going to join us. If you've enjoyed the episode, subscribe. And if you have subscribed already, thank you. Tell a friend. Look in the show notes for a Patreon account where you can help keep this podcast running, as well as a Discord server for those Patreons who just want to ask me more random questions. And if I don't know the answer, I'll do my best to find the answer, or perhaps find someone who could do it as part of an episode in the future. Thank you so much.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight. In a world so chaotic that misbehaves,
Melodies that echo show us six always. Colors intertwine, painting the sky. We're lost in the rhythm as the universe flies by. Oh, we're tuned in, feeling the beat of the unknown.